Hello, I'm Joe Glenton, and welcome to Warrior Nation, the only podcast in the UK offering a critical lens on the British military and its relationship with civil society.
Ian Cobain is an award-winning journalist with Middle East Eye. He is the author of Cruel Britannia and An Anatomy of a Killing. I just want to go right back to the start and ask where your interest, particularly in the Troubles, came from. Was this a patch you were just given as a young journalist, or was it something else?
No, I've long been interested in Ireland. I first went to Ireland North and South in 1985. A kind of sightseeing, I guess, just driving around the island and meeting people. And I have been in and out of the place as a journalist on and off for a long time. I became more interested, actually, after spending time looking at some of the more challenging aspects of British counterterrorism operations after 9/11 and 7/7, and realizing that we were deeply involved in some very serious human rights abuses alongside our allies in the so-called War on Terror. And that, allied with my long-standing interest in Ireland, led me to think that it might be worth me having another look at what we did in back in the day during our counterterrorism operations in Northern Ireland. So it started actually with the so-called War on Terror, and then me moving backwards.
Anatomy of a Killing is a brilliant piece of kind of you weave that narrative non-fiction thing so well. I think it would be helpful if you could just give us an overview of what you're getting at, what your thesis is in Anatomy of a Killing.
It was written largely with a British audience or readership in mind, although it seems to have gone down well in Ireland, both North and South, and reasonably well with people on both, you know, both sides of the house in the North, if you like. It was the idea really was to look at who Britain's opponents and enemies were during the Troubles, particularly the Provisional IRA, introduced to a British readership some idea of the sort of people who were drawn to political violence or felt compelled to turn to political violence. Because one of the, so often members of the IRA or former members of the IRA are presented as caricatures. They're so often presented in popular media as big hulking men in black leather jackets and sometimes dark glasses. Mm-hmm. And what's most striking once you meet people who were in the IRA is how very ordinary that they are, how they are, in fact, just like us. That's the most striking thing about them. And in some senses, it's the most disturbing thing, because you realise that people just like you and I could, under some circumstances, turn to political violence, ordinary people turning to political violence in extraordinary circumstances and extraordinary places. Mm-hmm. So that was the idea. And I wanted to show that these were ordinary people, And try and understand why, or apparently ordinary people were driven to behaving in the way that they did. My working subtitle when I was researching it was kind of, so why did you do that? So that was the idea. That was the idea. I wanted to produce a book which showed that how people like you and I could, under some circumstances, find themselves drawn to political violence.
And I think you've done that very successfully. I commend it. I commend it. It's fantastic. I've been reading a lot of books about Ireland lately. I have a developing interest myself, having been someone who served in the War on Terror, again, in where some of that stuff that we saw and did came from. But you've done an excellent job. There's something else which you've alluded to there. There is a gaping hole in British, I suppose, particularly English, I guess, public memory when it comes to Ireland. And it's not that long ago. It's not that long ago, but there seems, unless I suppose one example is Theresa May goes into a kind of summons the DUP to get a majority. There are moments like that when Ireland comes back and kind of bites the English in the arse, if you like. And suddenly we're all talking about, who are these people? Where have they come from? What is this place, which is so often written off as a provincial, irrelevant backwater? I know a lot of your work is about public memory, what things vanish and what things stay. What is the problem with public memory about Ireland and the English or the British or the narratives about the UK and UK national identity and the UK body politic? Where does it go in those intervening times?
I get the impression that a lot of Irish people know a fair bit about British politics and British history. I also am of the opinion that a great many British people do not know an awful lot about Irish politics and Irish history. It could be that the problem is a little larger than that, that there's aspects of our imperial past that we tend to mythologise and not examine rigorously. As far as Ireland's concerned, it is because the place is almost within touching distance, it is very difficult to understand. I particularly find it difficult to understand because I've been interested in it, in the place, pretty much all my adult life. I found it a fascinating place, and I don't understand why more people don't share my interest. It was badly reported during the Troubles, as you know, that the media didn't tell the stories of those people who were killed very often. If you're a member of the British Army, you might get a few paragraphs at the foot of a left-hand page of a national newspaper. Otherwise, it needed people to die in multiples rather than one or two, you know, one at a time before the media took interest. Some journalists did try and take interest, but found themselves pushing uphill against disinterested editors. I know TV journalists would say that they struggled to get documentaries commissioned about the Troubles simply because those doing the commissioning would know that their viewing figures would plummet whenever they broadcast a documentary about the Troubles, about Ireland.
Sure.
And so because there was that much there was that much apathy and that much lack of interest, and we had a Northern Ireland secretary saying that she didn't know until she went there that nationalists didn't vote for unionist parties and unionists didn't vote for nationalist parties. And I had to look at her age and realised, hang on, when the IRA were blowing up the City of London, you were well into your 20s. Did you not at any time think, oh, I wonder what that's all about?
Why,
and then try
happening?
And answer the question.
Yes.
It's so, a historian of Victorian Britain wrote a long essay about Victorian Britain, which he touched upon Ireland, and he described it as, he said, we fail to understand that what we could never remember, Ireland could never forget. He said, look at Ireland, there we have the great failure of our history. I am inclined to regard it as the one irreparable disaster of our history. And the ground and cause of it was a failure of historical perception.
Yeah.
So this has been around a long time. This lack of interest. I found it bewildering.
I was recently. This has been a theme throughout the other two episodes. But I was recently pulled up by a good friend who's a young man from West Belfast. Who he understood why I used the term the Troubles, but he said you have to be careful with that because he felt that term, as someone from the West of Belfast, someone from a nationalist background, that term is inadequate. And language is important here, isn't it? He said that term tends to frame this long conflict, hundreds of years of conflict, as something very brief and something that's not really anything. It's the Irish fighting each other. Do you recognise that characterisation? Is that something that has legs, do you think?
It's a bizarre euphemism to use to describe a conflict in which, in its latest episode, about 3,700 people were killed, lots of people hurt, lots of property destroyed, lots of misery inflicted. So I understand his concern about this euphemism. On the other hand, I have reached the conclusion that I'm not going to be too worried about language when describing, you know, I'm not going to be hamstrung by which word I should be using to describe a city or an area of an island. I'm not going to worry too much about that, really. Ah. But I understand his concern that it is a euphemism, and it's a strange euphemism.
So there are a number of sections which really jumped out at me in your book. I wanted to do originally in the vision for this small series, this short series, I wanted to do something about the militarised landscape and the securitised landscapes of the north, the police stations, the barracks, how they were there, how they're gone. And actually in reading your book, I found something even more compelling. In your book, you talk about the involvement of the military, the security services in town planning, in effect, in areas of Ireland. Particularly, there's a really interesting section on how a new estate in Belfast, which was built for Catholics and Nationalists, the degree to which the military and the British state were involved in shaping the kind of architecture and the landscape and the terrain of that place and planning around military aims. Can you just unpack that for us? Because I found it absolutely fascinating, and it was totally new information for me.
Yes, by the late 1970s, there was a planning committee sitting in Belfast, whose meetings were not publicised and whose minutes were not published. They're available now, but sitting on the committee was a senior police officer, officer of the Royals, the Constabulary, the RUC, and a lieutenant colonel from the British Army. At the time, I was looking at the police representative, who was a man called Jack Herman, who was then the deputy chief constable of the RUC and went on to lead it. And they were very concerned about roads and about housing. They were concerned about the routes north and south into the city. Mm-hmm. They were aware that most of Unionist Belfast was on the east side of the river and away from both the commercial and industrial parts of the city, and so they were concerned that they could lose control of routes from the west, and so had to maintain the security of routes from the north and the south. And this committee would actually look at the allocation of houses, of individual houses to individual families, and try to ensure that there weren't too many working class Catholic families being allocated housing close to the main routes north and south of the city. They also, as early as 1970, planners were talking about the possibility of building a motorway between the city centre and West Belfast,
yes,
which they referred to in their records as a prudent cordon sanitaire. Mm-hmm. And that motorway was built and eventually opened in 1983. And if you approach it, if you walk toward it from the city centre now, you'll see that there's an awful lot of open space as you're approaching that motorway. There's, you know, sort of all-weather sport pitches and parkland and such like. There's open space, and it was conceived not as primarily as a measure to convey traffic, but to place a physical barrier between West Belfast and the city centre,
sure,
which I thought was, when I came across this, I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then in the late 70s, as the housing estate known as Poleglass between West Belfast and Lisbon was being developed, it was built in a way that had just two roads bisecting it and then lots of cul-de-sacs, so the people who were being chased in a vehicle would find it difficult to get away. The entrance to the roads are wide open, offering wide fields of fire. A lot of it's pedestrianised, and the pedestrian passages are built to withstand the weight of an armoured vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So defensive planning was very much a thing in Northern Ireland by the late 1970s, and it did help shape the city, it's something which I just thought was worth exploring, really.
Yeah, and you did it exceptionally well. I just want to jump forward slightly. The Northern Ireland Legacy Bill is in its, I believe, its third reading. I want to say in the Lords. I was looking at this this week. Legacy stuff is obviously built into the Good Friday stuff. We've had some fascinating discussions on what legacy looks like top down, the blunt object, the approach of legacy, which is the blunt object, which is this bill, and bottom up legacy through reconciliation processes from below by people involved in the conflicts. But I just want to get your take on the bill.
Well, I, to some extent, I have some sympathy with people in government in London who think that Northern Ireland has to stop obsessing with the past and look forward. We need to move forward. You need to move forward. I get that. And I have some sympathy with that view. But I think this bill is another example of a failure of imagination and a failure of understanding and a failure of historical perception on the part of people in Westminster and Whitehall who don't understand that it's not really possible to use legislation in a way that will stop people being deeply concerned about what happened in the past and wanting further explanations about what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of understand it, but I think it's foolish, as you say. It's united people from all backgrounds. There is one or two Northern Ireland ministers have kind of let the cat out of the bag by saying that they want the legislation to protect former members of the security forces mm-hmm. from prosecution. And again, I can understand that. I can understand why they feel that they should, you know, why should somebody who was 19 in 1972 did something wrong? Why should they be prosecuted 50 odd years later? I can see the sense in that, but it's going to cause an awful. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to end, but I can't see it's going to end well. And whilst I understand the impulse, I do think that if somebody had shot my father, say, regardless who I thought was responsible, mm-hmm. I'd still want some. I'd want to know why, mm-hmm. and I'd probably want to see justice being yeah. done.
Something which has jumped out at me as a veteran, because I hear my former military colleagues going on about this stuff, because my generation of veterans, the Iraq and Afghanistan veteran, also had our kind of legacy bill and the debates around that in the overseas operations bill. And what always jumps out at me, and I'd like to hear your thought on this, is that it's always Private Smith, Corporal Jones, and it's never General Sir Mike Jackson, General Frank Kitson. There seems to be as we used to say in the army, shit rolls downhill. But that seems to be almost a class dynamic which runs through this thing. Is that do you agree with that? Am I just being unnuanced there, or do you think there's some truth in that?
Well, not entirely. It's worth remembering that a lieutenant colonel did face court martial following the death of Baha Moussa in Basra in 2003.
Yes. But, yeah, Mendonca,
but that is rare. Yeah. Yeah. I take the point. It's rare. Only one person was convicted at that court martial, and he was a corporal or a lance corporal. I can't remember which. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I understand your scepticism about the reluctance to see justice travelling upwards through the chain of command and beyond into mm-hmm. the Ministry of Defence.
Yes.
And that does seem to be the way. I think the one person who fired on protesters of Bloody Sunday was charged. Mm-hmm. But he was somebody who I think was a private soldier at the time. And yes. Responsibility for what happened there wasn't apportioned to senior officers. Yeah. And it certainly wasn't apportioned to the Prime Minister of the day, mm-hmm. who, when ordering members of the parachute regiment to move from Belfast to Derry, mm-hmm. Was asked by the then Cabinet Secretary, Burke Trend, are you sure you want to do that, Prime Minister? Mm-hmm. There have been allegations, unproven allegations, of brutality by these soldiers. Mm-hmm. And it was the Prime Minister who said, yeah, I want them to go. And yet just one soldier finds himself being charged. I understand your scepticism. I understand that why people might think that's unsatisfactory. Yeah. It's arguably one of the reasons why we should be drawing a close to prosecutions, maybe.
Yeah, sure. Just to broaden out the context, we've seen Sinn Féin has become this electoral machine, a very different beast to the Sinn Féin of yesteryear. We've seen this is a topic that's come up, a decline in the base of unionism. Younger liberal unionists are looking at things like organisations like the DUP and going, that's not really me. That's not really my bag, with their various, you know, their policies on gay marriage, on LGBT rights, on women, the kind of more than a flavour of creationism among the old base. With that in mind, what do you think what are the prospects? Is there going to be a united Ireland? That's what I'm getting at. What does that look like after all this? Is it going to happen in our lifetimes? Is it ever going to be a thing?
Is it ever going to be a thing? Well, I wouldn't rule it out, Joe. I certainly wouldn't rule it out. In our lifetimes, I don't know. I do think that in terms of electoral politics in the North, one of the interesting stories, it's not just the steady growth of support for Sinn Féin, mm-hmm. but the really quite rapid growth of support for the Alliance. And yes. one wonders whether young unionists, as you say, are looking at the DUP and thinking, I can't bring myself to vote for these people. You know, so So that's one of the interesting stories in the north. In the south, I don't know enough about politics in the south right now, 2022, 23, to be able to predict where that might be going. But in terms of the possibility of a united Ireland, it's always been a possibility. Yes, I think there's every possibility, every chance that we will, whether you and I are witnesses, I don't know, but that there will be a united Ireland at some point in the future. I think that's entirely possible. Of course, it was always, during the Troubles, there was always a sort of belief outside of these islands that in some way the British were selfishly trying to cling on to a corner of the island, and the Irish government desperately wanted to see their island united. Yes. And that was, in both cases, it was kind of the opposite of the truth. When the Labour Party was in opposition in the early 1970s, and it was known that they were starting to look in a very rudimentary, early way at the possible, what British withdrawal might look like, the Irish government lobbied hard in European capitals, and particularly in Washington, D.C., to ensure that it didn't happen, because they didn't want to inherit the problem that was Northern Ireland. And British governments, successive British governments, I think, saw Northern Ireland as a responsibility rather than a possession. They couldn't just walk away. But now the landscape, the political landscape, has changed so much that it's possible. What we don't know is, of course, is how militant loyalism would respond, as it looked like the world was moving towards that place.
Yes,
and how the population in the south, how, because a lot of people in the south are just very concerned about what was happening in the north, but actually not all of them. I remember chatting to a guy in a bar in Dublin, and he said, "Oh, Belfast, Beirut, all the same to me." This would be in the mid 80s, you know. So I don't know how much appetite there will be among people in the south to inherit that responsibility for the north. But electorally, it does seem like that's the direction of travel, both north and south. Sinn Féin have become an electoral power.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I mean, there are so many moving parts. I almost think that as I've started to read more and try to understand all, I'm actually more confused by aspects of it, because it is, it's incredibly complex. And that's something that's very apparent to me. What do you make of this? I see a tendency, but you've been looking at Ireland a lot longer than me, that British governments historically and now have tended to pick up and wield unionism and loyalism when it suits, and then kind of put it down. And I can remember the first time I went to places like Sandy Row and Tiger's Bay, where it's like it's remembrance every day. It's remembrance every day. Here it's a week or a month of build up, but there is these commitments are so profound in a way that it's just unheard. I've just never encountered that. Even in the military, people weren't that bothered. And it's grown recently. It's become a remembrance, and these kind of parades of obedience to the state have come more prominent, I suppose. But it's a very strange dynamic. Do you think there's a sense of, I suppose what I'm getting at, is there a sense of loyalists and unionists must know that they're kind of wielded? They're almost making this call to the to the British state, and they're often just disregarded in a way. It's a strange dynamic, isn't it?
It is, and of course, there's always been a high degree of distrust amongst those British people in Northern Ireland at successive British governments. But nevertheless, there seems to be occasion when they're prepared. I was struck by the way in which people were prepared, from a unionist background, were prepared to suspend their disbelief when Boris Johnson, as Prime Minister, told them that there would be no border down the middle of the Irish Sea as a consequence of Brexit. Mm-hmm. He was not being truthful, and he was not being honest, but nevertheless, people seem to embrace that rather than reject it as if these words as implausible.
Yes.
And it's it must be a very difficult experience for these for British people in Northern Ireland to know that the British successive British governments don't really think about them.
Yeah,
you know, don't think about them until, as you say, they're needed. I believe that the number one Google search in Britain after the 2017 general election, in which Theresa May blew her majority, parliamentary majority, was who are the DUP?
Yes.
Because she was having to form this alliance with them to prop herself, prop her government up. And there was people all over Britain thinking, I've never heard of this bunch, are they? Mm-hmm. But, it's difficult. It's very difficult and painful for a lot of people, I think, the way in which successive British governments treat them.
Sure. Sure. I've just a question that's kind of been playing in my mind. I don't know if you can speak to it. I understand the relationships between a lot of, I guess, older school Republicans and the Good Friday Agreement can be very complicated. My impression is that many people who were still committed to the struggle saw the Good Friday as a betrayal. But do you think in the longer term there are, physical force Republicanism isn't what it was. And that's not to be nostalgic about it, but it's obviously vastly diminished. But do you think that generation of people who fought, who started their community defence programmes, joined the IRA after Bloody Sunday, do you think they will look at the rise of Sinn Féin and the prospects for reunification and feel that they contributed to that? I mean, well, that's a very complex relationship I'm trying to unpack there. But I'm trying to get a sense of how the people who fought, the people who ended up in Longkesh, the people who fought that will look at this potential gradual march towards a reunified Ireland. I would assume it's not the image that they had. But how do you think they will view that, the guys who did jail time and suffered, etc.?
I know that some of them aren't at all satisfied by the Good Friday Agreement, but very few of them would want to go back to violence. So,
yes.
As somebody who did some serious jail time put it to me, he said, just because your car's is not running well, you don't want to go back to a horse and cart, do you?
Uh-huh.
And and there's many people like that. Of course, there were many nationalists and some Republicans who, even back in the 70s, were saying that the best way to get the British Army off our streets is to stop shooting at them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would no doubt say that they were proved right. But... Mm-hmm. Well, the problem was that by 72, 73, you know, the war was raging, and it was always going to take a long time to wind that down and persuade people to take a different route, a different course. So, was it worth it? I don't know. I mean, I suppose really they would, such people would have to speak for themselves, really, sure. Rather than lie on an Englishman in England to answer that question for them.
a final question, and we'll wrap up. Why do we need to understand the Troubles? What can it give us? And why is it so important that we do that?
It's important that we do it because the conflict isn't resolved. It's kind of frozen.
Mm-hmm.
It wait long enough, and it might be ossified, but at the moment it's not really resolved, and we should understand what happened. And we should understand Britain's role in the conflict and Britain's responsibility for the conflict in order to move forward. I mean, the peace process is just that. It's a process. It wasn't an act. It wasn't an event in 1998. It's an ongoing process.
Yes.
And we all have responsibilities. That, I also think we should take an interest in Irish history because... We're actually very close. You know, we're just a couple of islands, very short distance from each other. We have an awful lot in common linguistically, culturally. Mm-hmm. In so many ways, we have an awful lot in common. And we've enriched each other's cultures in so many ways, you know.
Ian Cobain, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thanks, Joe.
This has been Warrior Nation. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. We want to reach as many listeners as possible, so whatever platform you're hearing this on, please pop us a 5-star rating. Apparently, it really helps in terms of spreading the word. You can follow us on Twitter or Instagram on @ForcesWatch. This episode was recorded with music from Easy On Noise. See you next time.